Intermediate Court of Appeals is now in session. The Honorable Lisa M. Pinoza, Catherine G. Leonard, and Lawrence M. Reifert preside. Please be seated. Case numbers CAP-16-000679 and CAP-16-000782. Benjamin Paul K. Kona and Tammy M. K. Kona, counterclaim defendants at Belize versus S. Bang Apostolos and Robert A. Schmidt, counterclaim plaintiffs appellant, and Michael Borman, M.D., defendant appellant. Terrence O'Toole for defendant appellant. Robert A. Smith for plaintiff appellants, past bank of Apostolos and Robert A. Smith. Fred Paul Banco for counterclaim defendant at Belize. Argument on merit.
All right, good morning, counsel. First things, a couple of administrative matters. I understand we're going to have 15 minutes from you, Mr. O'Toole, 5 minutes on reserve.
I think it's 20 for us and 15 for Mr. Smith.
But in total, you're going to have 20 minutes, but you're going to have 15 up front, 5 reserves?
Yes.
Okay.
15 up front, 5 for rebuttal.
Okay. Very good. All right.
Do we need to make an oral motion of any kind? Are we able to?
No, if that is the understanding, and Mr. Smith, is that your understanding as well? Is that your agreement? You're going to have 15 minutes,
yes.
And you're not going to reserve any for rebuttal? Okay, thank you. And I apologize. Why don't you go ahead and make your appearances? Go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, judges. Mr. Borneman, Dr. Borneman is present in court, and given the fact that we are sharing time, I'm going to try to move fairly swift a pace here, recognizing that the court doesn't need a lot of rehash. With the court's permission, I'd like to take the issues a little bit about out of order and start with the issue of whether the credit of $315,000 should have been given to Dr. Borneman as opposed to the transfer of the Cagnoli property. And I believe that this court's decision in 2013 laid out a roadmap that told everybody what to do with that, and not sure what happened when it went back down to the trial court, but it didn't happen. And so Dr. Borneman, in addition to bearing a huge burden on punitive damages and other damages, has essentially denied the return of the balance of the equity in the property. So I won't go further than that. I think that 651C-8 is clear. Whichever's less here is you sell the property, you pay off the judgment, which was $597,000, and whatever the balance is should go to Dr. Borneman.
A couple of questions on that, Mr. O'Toole. So just to be clear, I mean, you're not challenging the voiding of the deeds. You're seeking credit for your client of what you have calculated to be $315,000. Is that correct? No, so you're not challenging the voiding of the deeds?
I am not challenging that. I'm not quite sure at this point how we are going to mechanically, I'm going to be candid with what I'm not quite sure mechanically how we undo this thing. And I wanted to tell the court at the beginning that because of the burden of the 10% interest, Dr. Borneman, without prejudice to this appeal, basically paid the punitive damage award plus all the accrued interest. So I'm not too sure how we do the...
When did that happen?
Michael O'Connor handled that, and this would have been, I want to say, in the last year or maybe a little bit more
okay.
than the last year.
Okay, so, because I think, and not to interrupt, and I know you don't have a lot of time, but the interest, how that credit would work vis-a-vis the interest and all that I hope you will address that.
Yes.
Because if he's paid, and I don't know if that's in the record, probably not.
It is not. It's not in the record.
And so I don't know how this court can address it, but I do think that if we are inclined to go back to Kona 3 in any way, it would be helpful if you could address that.
Okay, and I think maybe the easy answer is if it's treated as a credit, then there's a question of how does that get repaid? You know, how does that credit get applied?
Right. So I'm interest was calculated only on the punitive damages portion. Is that correct?
No, interest was calculated on the original $191,000, what's referred to as the 1994 award, and that came out to $597,000 with accrued interest, and I think that ran it right on to when it went back to the trial court.
Okay.
Recently.
So, but there is a judgment in this case,
yes,
right? And when the punitive damages were awarded, circa 2008, is that right?
Yes.
So the one roughly $1.1 million of additional interest got accrued, right?
Yes, it did.
And did it accrue from, so is that $1.1 million from that date?
Yes. And
what was that on?
That was on, I believe we went back and looked at it. My understanding is that was on the punitive damages.
Okay.
The interest that I just referenced was on the $191,000 1994 award, which took it up to $597,000. I think that's a standalone. And the punitive damage, and I'll kind of jump right into it. The punitive damage award, which the Supreme, I know I'm maybe preaching to the choir here, but you know, what are we going to do? But I do have some arguments that I think are meritorious. That interest that ran from 2008, when there was a $1.6 million, that was fully baked into the 2015, was fully baked in by the time the Hawaii Supreme Court issued its 2015 decision. So it was not a punitive damage award of 1.6. It was a punitive damage award of almost $3 million. And I realize I've jumped from point A to point B, but just to be clear so I finish my thought, we think there's two issues here. One is, if in fact this court were to determine that because of that, and because the Hawaii Supreme Court never addressed that issue in the decision, there's, I think, several ways to come at it. One is that the post-judgment interest statute, which is mandatory, so it's very hard for me to argue it's not, but then you have the overlay of the 14th Amendment. You know what I mean? How much can you pile on?
Okay. I know you have limited time, so
yes.
Let me just say that
yes.
Even if, assuming arguendo, in my heart of hearts, I agreed with you
yes.
about the punitive damages issue, we are bound by the Supreme Court's decision, and so
yes.
you... We're the wrong court to ask to change that. We can't say that the $1.6 million is wrong. There's a judgment entered on it, and the 478.3, I think, is the post-judgment interest statute. I don't see what relief we can provide on those issues, other than what was the proper amount of judgment and when it ran from. Maybe you can explain that to me.
Well, I think it's very tricky, and I came here fully understanding that this court isn't going to reverse the Hawaii Supreme Court. And
yeah.
I mean, the number of 1.6 is shocking. When you get up to 3, it's doubly shocking. So I think there's really two ways forward. One is, does the 14th Amendment and the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment look at that combined amount which existed at the time in 2015 when that decision came out and the court didn't address it? Our argument is those have to be looked at as one. It's not a 1.6, it's a 3 million. And how does that have any proportionality or reasonableness? So I would say 14th Amendment of the Constitution trumps that. Now, delicate.
Just so I understand your argument, you're saying at the time the Supreme Court issued its decision in 2015, which affirmed the 1.6 million punitive damages, it should have known that in effect, given the mandatory statutory post-judgment interest
right.
statutory requirement, that their judgment was in effect a $3 million judgment.
Yes.
That's what you're arguing.
That's the argument.
Was it argued to them at all?
Sorry?
Was that argued to them at all, as far as you know?
At the time, was it argued?
Yeah, to the Supreme Court.
I don't think so. I mean, I read back through it. Should it have been argued? Should somebody have looked at it? I don't know.
Because there were post-opinion motions, right?
Yes.
And even an amended judgment, which specifically affirmed the $1.6 million.
Absolutely.
By the Supreme Court.
Yes,
okay.
Absolutely. And so that is all true. And all I can say here is that if we look at what's fair and what's reasonable, and I know I'm preaching to the choir to an extent, that at a minimum, we would hope if this court says, you know, there's not much we can do, but we have concerns when you consider it's a $3 million judgment when the underlying judgment in 1994 was $191,000. And that most, that the other parties were sanctioned or punitive damage awards were $250,000. How can we get up to $3 million? And we basically told Dr. Morton, you're paying what people, more than what many people earn in a year in interest. It's about $160,000 a year. And this, you better get out of that place. It's not good. So I'm going to move on. But I do think it's a new issue. I think the court could certainly raise the issue, and we would then say we're in the wrong court, so we'd like the Hawaii Supreme Court to take a fresh look at it. But you can't combine the two and come away with it. This is fair. It's not fair. There's nothing fair about it. So I think I moved quickly through the credit of $315,400. I jumped over to punitive damages, and now we get into, at least for me, when I was trying to understand the labyrinth of decisions and appeals, just almost mind-numbing, you know, just trying to understand what happened to what decision, what happened to what judgment. So I think what we have here, I believe, is we have what's been referred to as the 1994 judgment, the first judgment.
In the Hanama Bay case, yes. Or in this case, yes. In the Hanama Bay case.
And so that's a predicate. I mean, that judgment, or another judgment, if it still exists, is a predicate to whether there can ever be a fraudulent transfer claim. Because if the transferor is not obligated, is no longer obligated to pay that amount, then there is no basis upon which to pursue the fraudulent transfer claim.
Right, but the fraudulent transfers claim was already pursued and reduced to judgment in this case, wasn't it?
The two that I have, and obviously stand to be corrected, we have the 1994 judgment. Interesting that the plaintiffs in the case moved to extend that judgment in 2004. And so somebody thought that that was the operative judgment. They extended it. It can't go out beyond 2014. And so that was the statute of repose at that point. That judgment is history. I believe counsel for the plaintiffs agree with that. But they argue, well, you know what? That judgment got modified by your court in 1998, reduced the total damages from $702,000 to $191,000. So, if that's the judgment, the 1998 judgment, that was, to the best of my knowledge, that was never extended. So by 2008, where's that judgment? And I don't see that the plaintiffs have addressed it. They raised it up and tried to get away from the 1994 judgment, and then talked about the 1998 judgment, but it doesn't, it takes you off a cliff. It's like, well, if that's the judgment, then by 2008, it had to be extended. It wasn't. And we know by now, 20 years has passed on that, so.
I think that the question, though, is, in the first judgment in this case was in 2001. Isn't that a material and significant factor in terms of the argument you're making? So in
yes.
Other words, there's a fraudulent transfer complaint brought in this case right after the jury verdict. But before a judgment was even filed, this case, in the Hanama Bay case, this case was filed.
Right.
And then you get a 2001 judgment, which was well before the 10-year period had run.
Okay. And I think that the underlying judgment, at least as I can tell from reading the opinions and the briefing, that people meaning the parties and the lawyers, had tended to look at the 1994 judgment as the underlying foundation of an award against the Smith and Abastillas. And even if it extends out to 1998, which I believe the plaintiffs agree, they're out of luck, and I don't know how that can change. It's got to be either 1994, which they extended and the statute of repose ran, or it's the 1998.
But Mr. O'Toole, I think what Judge Pignoza is saying is that we have we have a separate claim here. It's not just that, you know, the first judgment, you're right, but nobody's trying to enforce the first judgment anymore. They're trying to enforce punitive damages on a fraudulent transfers claim in a separate case.
Against Dr. Borneman.
Right, so.
And so, I believe I'm understanding what you're saying, and maybe I wasn't being clear, but I think the way that 94 and 98 judgment works is there has to be an underlying judgment against Smith and Evastelis in order for the plaintiffs to pursue any fraudulent transfer claim. It's a predicate. There has to be a presently enforceable debt against the transfer.
And that's easy to agree with when they bring the fraudulent transfers claim.
Yep.
But when the fraudulent transfers claim has proceeded to trial and judgment, aren't we looking at that post-trial judgment in this case as the operative date? And why not? I guess you're saying no, but that's, I think, where we're stuck here.
I understand. And to Judge Ganoza's point, if it was 2001, don't we still have the same problem? 2001 to 2011 is 10 years.
Well, you have a 2008 judgment. I mean, I think the question is, you're relying on cases like Wig, right? The Wig case was a garnishment action.
Yes.
There's no separate judgment in that case, nor in the other cases that I believe you cite from the other jurisdictions.
Yes.
So I think, so for instance, one of the concerns would be, if you take your position, then somebody brings a fraudulent transfer case, do you just run out the clock? This case has been up and down on appeal how many times? You just keep, you know, figuring out different issues to raise when you go back on remand, and I mean, 20 years goes by. You don't want. I mean, that's part of the concern, I think. But also the cases that you cite, I don't know that they are similar to this case. But I like your response. I know your light is red, but if you could just respond
to
that.
Yes, thank you. I'll sit down. I think that's right. It's tricky, you know, and all of us who are practitioners worry about that kind of stuff. It's like, what's the measuring stick? So at a minimum, it would be helpful maybe clarification on that so none of us step in it. But I think whether you, and I think the 2008 judgment, you know, is the hallmark of that is it was a huge punitive damage award against Borneman. But the judgment we're talking about is the underlying judgment against Smith and Evastelis. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Smith.
May I please the court? Is this the time that we are allowed? 15 minutes?
Yes.
All right, thank you.
Hey, can you just state your name and who? State your name for the record.
Is that
please.
Better?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. I have. My name is Robert Smith. I am a defendant appellant pro se. With me is Paz Abastelis.
Good morning.
Who is likewise a defendant appellant pro se.
Thank you.
We were going to divide this up, and I thought maybe the court might want to hear from her. But that's up to the court to say.
That's fine. You have 15 minutes between the two of you, but please proceed.
Well,
the light will come on, the yellow light will come on when you have 5 minutes left. Okay?
Yeah, we have, so it's 7 and 7, kind of.
Okay, go ahead.
Basically, I'm going to be covering the issue of retroactivity, and Paz will conclude things with what the consequences are if there is a lapse of in the judgment. All right. Rojas 2, which is what we've named the decision by Judge Nakayama, was in 2009. The Iona judgment was in 1994, 15 years earlier. And so this, to me, poses a clear question of whether the new principles that Justice Nakayama laid down can be applied backwards in time, 15 years, to Judge Iona's judgment. The question is, what is the trigger? What is the kind of judgment or form of judgment which triggers the running of the statute? The leading case that deals with this issue is the Ikezawa case, which has this tripartite test, and it's in every case since then for probably the last 20 years or so. And the tripartite test is there a new principle of law? Certainly true. Is there will the new principle of law further or retard the decision about retroactivity? And finally, is there an equitable result from all of that? I think we meet the criteria for each of those three tripartite tests. I didn't say, but I should backtrack to the judgment of Judge Iona, which was appealed to the Supreme Court, to the ICA, this court, and there was a 30-page unpublished opinion, but the end result was, although the damages were $700,000 in the Iona judgment, it was cut down to $191,000 and remanded to Judge Maureen Milk to do what had to be done to clean up the rest of the issues, the monetary issues. And so after some dickering back and forth, she came out with a final judgment as to all claims and all parties, and that was achieved by, first of all, incorporating the 30-page opinion or so of this court, and then going on to recite how the parties had decided to resolve the monetary issues. Those two items then led to the final judgment. Now, this has nothing to do with the Rojas 2 case, because the ICA, this court, vacated in part and affirmed in part. That made the judgment invalid, and that was the basis for the principle of law which Judge Nakayama laid down. But that didn't matter, because it got to Judge Milk's on remand, and she did what she did and said what she did. And all of that is totally consistent with the Rojas 2 decision. So we wind up with a final judgment, and that was in 2009. The judgment was entered in 1999, and 10 years lapsed. There was no extension, and so the judgment lapsed in 2009, and nothing to do with retroactivity. Right. The last thing I want to say is, in Mr. Benko's responding, answering brief, he talks about tolling. I think there's a misconception here, and I think that what we have in the lap statute is a statute of repose about which there is no tolling at all. And I would like to give the court the citations from our opening brief where the court can find proof of that. And so I would refer the court to the opening brief, page 16, 19, 21, note 7, 22, 25, note 9. And the court will find a uniform principle laid down that a statute of repose cannot be told. At this point, I will turn it over to Paz Abbasidi.
Ms. Abbasidis?
Good morning.
Good morning. If you could just speak up a little, okay?
My name is Paz Abbasidis.
Good morning.
I have a medical degree. I'll make this brief, and I'll read it. Under the unanimous Weed case, Justice Klein wrote that when judgment lapses, quote, the judgment, together with the rights and remedies appurtenant to it, are conclusively presumed paid and discharged as a matter of law. It's a presumption that is not debatable. It's conclusive, presumed paid, and discharged as a matter of law. Fraudulent transfer suit is an appurtenant collection remedy, just like attachment, garnishment, or execution. Under the HAFTA, only a creditor can sue for fraudulent transfer. If the Hanama Bay judgment lapse, then the Conas are no longer our creditors and can no longer maintain their fraudulent transfer against us. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Ms. Abbasidis. Mr. Smith, thank you very much.
I have a question, if I may, and either one of you can answer this. So, the judgment that you're arguing that has lapsed is either is Judge Milk's judgment, is that correct?
2009 is the final judgment.
But wasn't there the final judgment entered in this case prior to the lapsing of the 10 years from that?
From the very beginning, he put his pendants on our house. Maybe so. I'm not good on dates. Mr. Smith and Mr. O'Toole can answer that. But we view, Judge Klein views fraudulent transfer case as a pertinent, and that it's no difference from execution, garnishment, and attachment. It's a means that Mr. Benko used to collect.
Thank you. Mr. Smith, do you have anything to add up to that?
What was the question, Mary?
Well, I guess the question was, when the fraud, I think the argument is that the original judgment in the other case that we kind of are calling the Hanama Bay case, the argument is that's lapsed, therefore you can't seek a remedy based on in the fraudulent transfers case, right? I mean, that's basically the argument. Because that judgment lapsed, this judgment goes away as well.
And your question is?
And my question is, since this case was filed before the statute of limitations or statute of repose expired on the other case, on the 1999 judgment in the other case, and was reduced to judgment in this case, aren't we really counting from the date of the judgment in this case, in the fraudulent transfers case? Isn't there a new judgment that Mr. Benko's client gets 10 years from?
I have a hearing defect, which is very serious.
Okay.
And usually I have a stenotypist or a note taker, but there wasn't time for that.
Okay.
At this hearing, so I'm not getting the court's question.
Okay, let me, and I'm probably talking too fast. Okay, so here's my question. Does... Okay, so your argument is that the 1999 judgment of Judge Mills is no good anymore based on the statute of limitations, right?
Well, we have two. We have Judge Iona's.
Right, 94.
If prospectivity is applied, that takes care of that. His judgment is governed by what the law was back in 1999. If the prospectivity is not observed still, that leaves Judge Milk's judgment, which comports with Justice Nakarama's principle that you can't have a judgment which is vacated in part. That's not a final judgment. All right, there was a remand to take care of that issue, and there was a final judgment. So that was compliant with Rojas 2 and leaves us with a final judgment and a lapse of the judgment because no extension was given or requested, and so it was a lapse.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith.
May it please the court, Fred Benko for the appellees and original plaintiffs, Kekomas. The Kekomas are represented here this morning in court. First of all, and I apologize for my voice, it's raspy and soft, so please bear with me. First, I'd like to thank you for continuing the oral argument for a short period due to my circumstances. Getting to the argument on the merits, it's been my observation that when arguments from an appellee are vague, ambiguous, uncertain, totally mistaken, it's a high likelihood of being a frivolous appeal. And that's what we've posited in this case. Dr. Borneman has raised three issues: the supposed lapse of the judgment, the claimed interest of $315,400 in the Cam Highway property, then the gross unconstitutionality of the interest award, and the punitive damages. As one of the court members has already pointed out, wasn't that punitive damages affirmed by the Supreme Court? Yes, indeed, 5-0. But I'd like to point out some figures that, now that oral argument is occurring, I think this court should take into consideration. It's certainly not unconstitutional. Mrs. Kekona and Mr. Kekona's problems actually began in 89 with a lawsuit by Smith and Abastillas against my clients over a partnership at Enoma Bay. The trial occurred, took 4 weeks in 1993 before Judge Iona. This is 2018. So if you take the years from the beginning of the underlying lawsuit to today, you have the passage of 29 years. The interest, however, has only accrued since 2008 with Judge Marks's entry of the judgment, I think in February of 2008.
And just so we're clear, you're talking about the $1.3 million interest on the punitive damages award?
That is correct.
Okay.
So, out of 29 years, interest has only been charged for the last 8 years. Now, that seems to be eminently fair, but let's take this case. Started in 1993 when we detected Smith and Abastillas moving property around. It's been 25 years since 1993, and yet interest has only been charged for 8 of those years. It's not pre-judgment interest, it's post-judgment interest. I think that interest award doesn't even reach constitutional question because it's so eminently reasonable. 8 years out of 25.
I think part of the argument, and you know, address this as you will, but the argument from Mr. O'Toole and Dr. Borneman is that, you know, the $1.6 million punitive damages award kind of, in part, was based on the delay factor, right? I mean, so I think
who's the only party in this case who's trying to move it ahead? The plaintiffs, Kekkonen's. You'll see our motion before this court in 2010. Judgment 2008 by Judge Marks by 2010. Mrs. Kekkonen, Mr. Kekkonen had already died. Mrs. Kekkonen was getting to her late 80s. We made a motion to expedite. Did you see them joining us? No, you did not. We're the only party that has tried to move this case along. So, with all due respect, Your Honor, the 8 years of interest was definitely not due to the plaintiffs. I would like to diverge at this point back to the original argument raised by Mr. O'Toole, but the interest of a $315,400 is still reserved, hidden, or otherwise contained in the Camp Highway property. This court is well known for, if you don't raise it below, don't raise it for the first time to us. They never mentioned any figure like $3,400 before Judge Nishimura, leading up to her 2016 third judgment. They never mentioned any figures. So down below, they're vague. We claim an interest. We know the deeds were all canceled, and we didn't appeal from that. So the deeds should be canceled. But now before this court, that's the first time I've ever seen a figure, $315,400. I think this is a frivolous appeal.
So your point is that, as I understand the argument, it's the equity on the, I refer to it as the Kaneohe property. I've heard you folks refer to it as the Kamehameha property, right? Okay. So the Kaneohe property. So the deeds transferring the property to Dr. Borneman were voided as part of the
at least
2008
three times.
As part of the 2008 and 2016 judgments, okay? So as I understand the argument, they're not challenging the voiding of the deeds. They're not seeking to undo the transfer back. They're seeking to get the equity on what they assert was the full value of the property, right? So there's the $191,000 from the Hanama Bay judgment. There's the interest on that $191,000, which they assert comes up to, what is it, $570,000. And they assert that the Kaneohe property was worth, in 2015, like $900,000. And so that they, I think, is that what you understand? They're asking for the equity, right, on that property. So,
deeds are canceled.
So my question to you is, You're making the argument that they never raised this $315,000 amount argument before. Is it your position that they never sought the equity on that property? Dr. Borneman never sought the equity on that property?
They did, I think, in their reply briefs and a supplemental memorandum, but never set forth the figure. Unbelievable. They're coming up here with this brand new claim. You sue somebody for $315,400, good, you have a figure. But you just say, in general, oh, we still claim an interest in their property after the deeds have been canceled three times.
So let's wind this back a little bit.
Okay.
In this court's 2013, I believe it was, opinion, right? And that's what Dr. Borneman relies upon, that's what was discussed earlier. There is a section in that opinion that specifically addresses what is an appropriate remedy or the variety of different remedies that are allowable when you have a fraudulent transfer claim that has been successful, as you folks have succeeded on your fraudulent transfer claim. We're now in the portion of this case of figuring out what is the appropriate remedy, or at least that 2013 opinion addressed it. So was that 2013 opinion, how was that 2013 opinion properly addressed by the circuit court on remand after 2015?
Basically, it's a moot decision because it was overturned by the Supreme Court's ruling.
The Supreme Court only addressed the punitive damages claim against Mr. Borneman.
And we had already withdrawn our, we never raised the issue of the special damages before the Supreme Court. We had abandoned that issue because we didn't want to get caught in the crossfire between special damages and the properties. So we just abandoned the issue. It's really...
You abandoned... Say that again. What are you claiming you abandoned?
Let me explain. Opposing counsel hasn't mentioned it. At least in the second and third trials, we stipulated before trial to the $253,000 figure, which was the $191,000 original judgment that was... that part of it was upheld by the ICA. Then we stipulated to the interest on that judgment, which brought you up to $253,000. After this court's opinion in 2013, we abandoned the claim. The Supreme said already decided.
Right, but the Supreme Court only vacated our ruling to the extent of our ruling on punitive damages. The Supreme Court's conclusion is we vacate the ICA's judgment on appeal to the extent it vacated punitive damages and remand to the circuit court for further proceedings. The Supreme Court did not disturb the other part of our 2013 judgment that Judge Ginoza has been discussing. So on remand, so we had instructions for what the circuit court was to do on remand to figure out the remedy, not on the punitive damages. You know, we're not talking about the punitive damages. We're talking about the remedy for, you know, the fraudulent transfer, the remedy under the fraudulent transfer statute, which is laid out in that 2013. I don't want to paraphrase it, but it's laid out in that opinion. I think our question is, how did the circuit court judge address that part of our opinion from 2013?
If it did address it, after four or five hearings, numerous briefs, it did render its remedies, which are contained in the 2016 third judgment.
At the same time,
it had the Supreme Court's decision, it had the ICA's decision, and it entered all the remedies it thought were appropriate. Judge Nishimura had conducted the very first trial. In this case, she rendered what she thought was an appropriate answer to both sides, under the understanding that we had abandoned our claim to avoid the conundrum of either special damages or the property. We just abandoned that. Okay?
So do you dispute at all that the value of the property, the Kaneohe property, in 2015, at the time of the remand, was the $900,000-some-odd, and if so, do you dispute that number, or is it something that you just don't go there?
Well, in a memorandum filed at the time of the, just before this 2013 ICA decision, we moved in the trial court to increase the bond, cash part of the bond, from $1,350,000.
This is to stay the prior judgment pending the appeal?
Right, because we saw the delay in effect, and in fact, in that motion, I believe, they said the outstanding interest was already 70% of the judgment. Borneman might have picked up on that and said, you know, I think that's a lot of interest. Could it be constitutional? But they never appealed from that or the original supersedious bond of cash of $1 million plus three properties. If this court would look at Part 52, Section 23, page 750, you'll see Dr. Borman's filings about his references to the values of the property. At that time, he valued the property at $650,423. So, number one, they've been all over the place. Number two, tough to pin them down. But number three, it doesn't matter because the deeds were canceled. They never got a favorable contradiction to that cancellation.
You mean it was never addressed on appeal?
Right. Nor on any appeal. In fact, this court, in its 2006 opinion, addressed the fact that you're allowed to get punitives along with the property itself. All the case law goes that way. In a subsequent decision, and I can't remember if it's this court's or the ICA Supreme's, Ohio case of Loca France achieved some prominence because it was either this court or the Supreme's that said we're following that case. There, the victim not only got his damages, but he also got all of the property that had been transferred with no credit whatsoever for what had supposedly been paid for. And that is resurrected, strangely, by the Borneman brief at the very end, pages 34, 35, 36. He says, well, really, the court should never have cited Loca France. We believe it's erroneous. It was erroneous when decided. Folks, the Loca France decision was decided in 2006 by either this court or the Supremes. And this is a venue for oral arguments on live cases, not a place to write law reviews. And they're bringing up of Loca France after 12 years now in a decided case strikes me as a law review article.
So the punitive
makes the whole appeal again. The whole appeal, in our opinion, is frivolous.
The punitive damages award has been paid?
Yes.
Okay. So what is left in this case is what? The interest issue?
If they had never appealed, there won't be any issues left. But certainly Mr. Smith, with his appeal on this supposed continued existence in Judge Allen's decision, I just couldn't believe he's bringing it up. First of all, the final judgment against Smith and Paz was entered by Judge Marks in 2006. How do you wait till 2016 to challenge that decision? I've never seen anything like this. Let me clarify a couple things about the Iona decision. 4-week trial, Judge Iona rendered a decision in 1993, a judgment actually. On appeal, I would have gone to this court. This court said, it's not a final decision. Please fill in these pukas. That was done in 1994. They appealed from the Iona decision. 1997 and 1998, an earlier panel of this court knocked out $500,000 in damages, but continued the $191,000. Okay. This court's judgment on appeal terminated for all time that Iona 1994 judgment. We find that in the earliest statutes of Hawaii law, which is why I included a copy of the 1905 statute that has been interpreted numerous times. It's far from a new principle of law.
Make your point clearer, Mr. Binkle. What are you saying about the statutory history?
Oh, yes. Then the case went to Judge Mills.
No. You're saying that the statute has been clear.
This court...
What point are you making about the statute?
Mr. Smith says it's being applied, or this principle of law is being applied retroactively. It is not being applied retroactively. In the first case, it's called Segelson. S-E-G-E-L, S-O-N, something of that nature. And it's at 20 Hawaii, 20 Hawaii 225. The court there held that it's got to be a final judgment, and all conditions and all contingencies must be eliminated before the lapse statute even starts. That is right in accord with the Marcos decision by the Supremes in 2009.
Yeah, I think Mr. Smith's argument, I mean, as I hear it and have read it, is that he's arguing that Rojas shouldn't be applied retroactively. But be that as it may, in terms of the argument that's being made by both appellants, that the underlying, as I've referred to it, as the Hanama Bay judgments, whether it's the 94 or the 98 judgments, having lapsed, our questions have been the cases that are cited. My suggestion is the cases that have been cited don't involve subsequent cases where a separate and independent judgment has now been entered prior to the lapsing of those other judgments in the first case. A separate and independent judgment has been entered in this case.
Correct, Your Honor. They just haven't understood that, so they keep raising the issue over and over again, but only starting in 2016, because the judgment being against Mr. Smith and Ms. Abastillas in 2006, the question is, why did they wait until 2015 in June to raise it for the first time? You know, if you're a judgment debtor and you see something magical appear in a subsequent decision, you want to get that decision before the appropriate court as quickly as possible. They waited 9 years.
Part of the assertion, right, is that the 1994 judgment by Judge Ayona was extended, so until 2014.
As a matter of caution, I extended it. Of course, with all the lawsuits swirling around, remember we were sued 10 times by Smith and Aniston.
Yeah, I'm just pointing out in terms of the timing, I think that's at least the assertion as to why they then raised it in 2015. But that's the argument, if you wish to address it.
They claim they weren't a party to the case anymore. From 2006 to 2015, Mr. Smith argues that we were not parties to the case. We knew about Life of the Land versus Ariyoshi, but we decided not to use it because we were no longer parties in the case. Suddenly, in 2015, in June, he's a party to the case again. I don't think you can jump in and out of lawsuits as you wish. That's a cherry picking at its highest. Also, I would like to point out some of the errors that opposing counsel has made in laying this case out. This court asked them, well, if the Supremes affirm the $1.6 million in punitives, wouldn't that naturally lead to an inference that, oh my God, the interest right on that date is about 70%. Maybe we ought to raise it at this time and get some sympathy out of the Supremes, or at least bring it to their attention. Did they do that? No. Next thing they do is bring a motion for reconsideration. Do they mention that? No. Here they're sitting with another $1.1, $1.3 million in liability for their client, and they don't raise the issue. Again, they don't timely raise the issue. They wait till it goes back before Judge Nishimura. Can you pick and choose when to raise your issues, even though they're obvious, even though you have an avenue by a motion for reconsideration to say, oh, Supremes, this could do us, you know, harm, great harm, because by affirming this judgment back to 2008, we're probably going to be deemed with a statutory interest. Raise it then. Raise it timely. I think the Supreme Court would have addressed it at that time. Therefore, in closing.
Before you close, I'm sorry, if I may, can I interrupt? Okay, so I'm still sort of stuck on this issue right now, the credit for the property based on the 2013 decision. I think, and Mr. O'Toole will address this presumably in rebuttal, but I think the argument is that, and I don't want to use the wrong numbers because I haven't memorized the numbers, but that the property was worth more than the judgment amount at the time that the fraudulent transfers judgment was entered and the property was voided. And so the property was voided, and the statute, as we laid it out in 2013, says you get the lesser of the amount, you know, the amount that the judgment would be, or the property. Now, if the property's worth more, what he's asking for, I believe, is a credit between those two numbers. Now, at this point, it's history in the sense that he's already paid the punitive damages with interest. But I think what he's asking for is for some, perhaps, is some of that money back for that difference there. I mean, he's asking for other things. But on this issue, I think he's saying, hey, wait a minute, I didn't get credit for what that property was worth.
Judge, the three juries found this to be a fraudulent conveyance. He didn't pay a penny for this property. They dummied up documents, which is why I took some care to lay out the fraudulent notaries, the fraudulent deeds, everything.
And I agree with you. That ship has sailed. Okay, we're talking about what the remedy is for that. I mean, you know, we're not trying to revisit that. You know, that there was liability. What we're looking at, or what I'm trying to understand, is what was the proper remedy? That was a question that we tried to clarify in 2013 for remand, okay? Is that what was the remedy for that? Not whether there was a fraudulent transfer.
No,
but
that is the basic point. The cases that we cite say in a fraudulent transfer, to discourage these things from happening, not only does the creditor get his money damages, but he also takes the complete property transfer.
Okay, I see what
there is no remedy for this great wrong, which has taken 25 years. There is no other remedy than punitives and all the property transfer. That's the thrust of Loca France. That's been the thrust of every decision in Horizons.
So in other words, you disagree with that portion of our 2013 decision, where we said, not on the punitive damages, but you disagree with the other analysis based on the fraudulent transfer statute, that you got one remedy or the other.
Yeah, with all respect to the court, I think that those issues were somewhat decided in 2006 when all three of these parties were appealing the first time. And by the way, I don't recall Dr. Borneman ever raising this in 2006. Now that I think about it, why not? Because they thought of it only on motions for reconsideration before Judge Nishimura. They never raised this issue of, oh, I wanted credit for the property. And the first time they ever mentioned a figure was before this court. I find that highly improper. Anyway, to close up our argument, Dr. Borneman's raised three issues. Mr. Smith has raised one issue that overlaps. The retroactivity argument has no case law in support. It would defeat all the earlier statutes of Hawaii regarding fraudulent or statutes of limitations and lapse. The decision of the Supreme Court in 2009 just fleshed out what the earlier cases had done and the earlier laws. On their second argument, which was Dr. Borneman's loan, a claim for $315,400, never before raised, could have raised it 12 years ago on the first appeal before this court and the Supremes. Then his third issue is unconstitutional amount of damages and interest. Well, he got his decision in the Supreme Court's 2015 decision. So I ask this court, why is he here again on the same issue? And as far as the statutory interest, could have raised it before the Supremes, could have timely raised it before the trial court, never did, came up in motions for reconsideration, supplemental memos, and the like, never timely raised. Thank you very much. We pray that on behalf of the Kekomas, this court will grant us a dismissal finally of their appeal and any other remedies under Rule 38 that it deems fit. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Benko.
I'll be very brief. There's nothing vague or ambiguous about this court's 2013 decision on how one deals with a fraudulent transfer. So I don't understand the arguments that that's confusing. The statute is totally clear, so I'm not even going to do that. I've heard arguments about, well, you know, Warnerman never had any interest in the property. You know, that's throwing a lot of...
What would be helpful is, I think part of what Mr. Benko is arguing, Mr. O'Toole, is that after our 2013 decision, when it went back down,
yes,
that wasn't raised to Judge Nishimura.
And I'm at a very big disadvantage. I was hired to do the appeal and to try to get Dr. Warnerman out of that heck of a mess. Michael O'Connor handled the case on remand, and all I could tell you is what he told me. My understanding, but it's, you know, it's, my understanding is that issue was raised and it was rejected, but somebody who knows more about it than me would have to confirm that. I don't want to make statements to the court that I can't support, but I believe that's true. I think they just sailed right on by, or they, meaning the trial court, just sailed by. You know? The second part, and if there's more information the court would like, I'm sure on these appeals, it's less than you want is more information, but we can get it, and I can get it from the trial attorney, Mr. O'Connor, if that would be helpful.
Well, we have the record.
Okay.
Well, I mean, if we need it, we'll let you know.
There is nothing frivolous about being the recipient of a $3 million in combination, effectively punitive damage award. And you can parse it and argue all you want that is... counsel for the plaintiff said the interest only ran from 2008. Well, it only ran from 2008 at $160-some thousand a year. This is not chump change. And I realize, and I won't go back over there again, I realize it's a difficult situation, but I would suggest that procedurally, there was no award on post-judgment interest until it went back to the trial court. Did I wish that somebody had raised it with the Supreme Court? Yes, but I don't think that's fatal. I think what we ended up with is like the Hawaii Supreme Court. Nobody was looking at that, and they couldn't be, because for the Hawaii Supreme Court to have parsed that 1/6 and said, well, this is for attorney's fees, this is for aggravated circumstances, a lot of it, judges, as you mentioned, a lot of it had to do with, you know, the concern of the Hawaii Supreme Court on delay. Well, 10% interest isn't a bad return for anybody. So I would just ask the court, to the extent you can, to at least raise the issue. I think none of us, I won't pretend to speak for you, but speak for myself, I don't think any of us feel good about a punitive damage award when you got basic damages of small six figures, and this guy, Dr. Warnerman, walks in and gets hit by a 2x4. So I hope there's a way forward, and if not, maybe the right way is that we've got to take that one up the next step, but I think there's a due process issue there. And the due process clause is going to trump there's two ways out. The due process clause is either going to trump the post-judgment interest, because you can't do both, or the Supreme Court maybe would take another look at it and say, you know, we kind of missed that. You know, that's really pretty onerous. And so we'll adjust the punitive damage award if they don't want to tinker with the post-judgment statute. Thank you very much. Always an honor to come here. Thank you for your time. And Dr. Warnerman.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Stathis-Gillis. We'll take this matter under advisement. Thank you.
All right.
meeting,